Chapter 20. Tilbury and the Blood of My Heel. Friday is day 7, and something of a red letter day as I reach the banks, but not the building societies, of the River Thames at Tilbury. It's a major milestone in my journey, and I celebrate in fine style with a pack of wafer-thin ham from Asda. Admittedly, it's a moment that would have had more significance if my father had passed this way, but there's no road crossing here, so he would have used the Dartford Tunnel a few clicks west. As for me, well, I had to come this way because Tilbury is home to one of Britain's largest shipping container terminals, and it would have been a bit weird of me not to take a look. Tilbury is one of the most ancient ports on the Thames. A fort was built here by Henry VIII. It's where Queen Elizabeth I once came ashore to inspect her army, and it's even believed to have been the site of a Roman settlement. But, as I say, I'm not really bothered about that stuff. I'm more interested in the London container terminal. For as well as handling a variety of bulk cargo, mainly timber and cars, the terminal is also the main UK hub for importing paper. I ask the man at the gate if they do tours. He says they don't. I ask the man at the gate if they do tours for VIPs. He says they don't. I ask the man at the gate if they do tours for VIPs who keep out of everyone's way and promise not to be a nuisance. He says they don't. It's fun to stand over the road and watch the terminal at work, my mind afizz with images of timber and cars and paper. I love the sense of mystery. What treasure lies within each container? Is it timber? Is it cars? Is it paper? As I marvel at the sophistication of the computer-controlled crane system stacking the containers, I have a vivid sense of how the world will be when robots take over in about 20 years' time. Bill thinks it will take longer. This is Bill Oddie, by the way. He's been with me all day. But he's wrong about this one, and I think he knows it. It's good to have Bill with me. It's the kind of comfortable friendship where both parties can happily share a silence. And we do, for the best part of 3 hours, so that it becomes increasingly unclear whether we're sharing a silence or I'm just putting up with Bill's. It may very well be that I cast him into a sulk when I said seagulls were the jackals of the sky. I don't even know what I meant by it, but I saw his cheek twitch, and I think it was the last thing either of us said. As we head to the ferry port to take the short crossing over to Gravesend, Bill gets a text on the bird phone. The mobile he keeps exclusively for alerts on rare bird sightings. Someone's just spotted a white-crowned sparrow in Dorset, and I am sorely mistaken if I think he's going to miss that. He calls an Uber, and before I can say boo to a goose, not that I would when Bill's around, the diminutive birdaholic has packed himself off in a Dorset-bound cab that will cost him £200 I know he doesn't have. Fare thee well, old friend, with your noculars, footnote, poetic abbreviation of binoculars, and your jerkin of 1,000 pockets. May the avian god smile down on you on this day and all days. When walking, I often like to pretend I'm a car. Listen carefully when you cycle past me on a straight bit of road, and you'll most likely hear me making the noise of a family saloon accelerating. And with Oddie time now over, my imaginary car of choice is a Vauxhall Cascada. Obviously, I'd never drive one in real life, as it's a bit of a hairdresser's car, but in the land of make-believe, no such stigma applies. I'm looking for a ferry, and as I negotiate a corner by making the sound of a Cascada dropping down a couple of gears, I notice a van bearing the distinctive livery of the BBC. It's an outside broadcast unit, and standing next to it is none other than CBBC's Steve Backshall. It's 7 p.m, so most of his supporters have been taken home by their mums. But Steve, ever keen to raise his own profile, is about to do an interview with the BBC's Neither One Thing Nor Another programme, The One Show, so-called because that's how many brain cells you need to watch it. Footnote. Eamon Holmes gave me that one. Love you, Aim. As they go on air, I'm delighted to see that the interviewer is Giles Brandreth. Now, I love Giles. A lot of people think he's just a privileged posh boy, but I've researched him on Wikipedia. And other than founding a teddy museum in 1998, which admittedly is a bit odd, Brandreth could hardly be more normal. Yet just because he went to private school, took to wearing a cape when at Oxford, and his middle name is Daubney, people suddenly think they can make judgments about him. Well, it's not on. I know loads of people called Daubney. Who doesn't? As I eat the last of my Asda ham, I watch the two men talk. Giles is, as ever, a class act. A raised eyebrow here, a touch on the arm there. A kindly nod while Backshall drones on, betraying not a jot of the contempt he must surely hold for the programme that employs him. But my eyes drawn to Backshall, his wide-eyed expression, his constant references to all the money he's raised, his cloying self-satisfaction, and his laughter. Oh, the guy can't stop laughing. He's laughing right now. It seems that in Backshaw world, everything is funny. Beaming and laughing and smiling and laughing and talking and laughing and fundraising and laughing and being Steve Backshaw and laughing. I watch all of this spewing from his mouth like the suds from a cartoon washing machine gone haywire. He is so pleased with himself. You'd think no one else was doing a walk. Well, they are. Me. And with that, a thought suddenly erupts in my mind like one of those geezers that smells of Trumps. Footnote. It's at this moment that I realise I have actually trumped, an unpleasant habit I'm working hard towards eradicating. Since my journey began, I've been doing my best to avoid the spotlight, but maybe I've got things anus about chest, footnote, arse about tit. The more I chew it over, the more I think that my father's memory shouldn't be hidden from view like some sausages in a fridge. We live in the age of sharing, linked up, Instagram and the like. If it's fair game to tell the whole world when you last took toilet or what you had for breakfast, perhaps sausages from the fridge, then surely it's only right that I should share the memory of the man who made me. And if it's fair game for Backshaw to speak to the British public on the flagship Chit Chat magazine show, then it's surely only right for Partridge to peck at that pie too. It's one interview. Big deal. It's not like I'm making a six-part Sunday night BBC One series about it. That ship has sailed. I'm fine with it. Move on. I jog over and thrust my hand towards Steve, calmly ignoring the producer's frantic gestures, telling me to keep back. Alan Partridge, I don't believe we've had the pleasure. I put the emphasis on pleasure so that we all know I mean the opposite. As our hands lock, we begin the traditional up-and-down greeting action. I quickly realise his shake is way firmer than mine. I try to get up to his level without him realising, but end up gritting my teeth, and I think he notices. Off-camera, the producer's still going bananas, and some of the stuff he's miming at me is pretty industrial. If this was Give Us a Clue, almost all of it would have to be cut, as I believe a lot of Lionel Blair's stuff was in the later years when he became increasingly blue. But Brandreth knows me. We once rehearsed a panto together, although my part, Twanky's friend, was subsequently cut before the opening night, and he welcomes me warmly. I start chatting and tell Giles and the viewers that I'm also doing a walk.
"How splendid," says Giles.
Now, there aren't many broadcasters who'd think to use a word like splendid on primetime TV, but I guess that's part of Giles' gift. He goes on,
"You and Steve are both in the midst of walks, but whereas your feet are shod, Steve's are, how to put this, al fresco."
Al fresco. Again, brilliant. I have no idea what he means, but it's quite brilliant. Then I realise Backshaw has nothing on his feet. He's doing his sport relief walk with no shoes on. Of course, Sport Relief requires its annual celebrity to add a twist to the feat of endurance, be it asking David Williams to swim open-mouthed into sewage, or getting Eddie Izzard to drive 100 marathons in 100 days, and this is Backshaw's angle, Zola budding it around the place like a wally. Wowzers, I say. I'm pretending to be impressed, but the arrogance staggers me, and I think it staggers Giles, too. Who walks without shoes on? Who does he think he is? John Lennon from the Beatles? Then again, it does sound kind of fun. You know what, Steve? I'm going to walk with mine off, too. Well, I can almost hear the gasps. This is great TV. You'd think I'd be a bit rusty, not having been live in front of the nation for years, but I have come alive. Adrenaline's flying around my body like it used to when Angela said she'd made one of her chicken pies. Footnote. Call me, please. By now, my shoes and socks are off. I've decided to roll up my trousers and I'm hopping from foot to foot like a madman. Oh no, my feet haven't got any clothes on. What do I look like? I bet the viewers at home are killing themselves at this. Call the cops! Call the cops! My feet need to get arrested for indecent exposure. I've got to hand it to Giles. How on earth he isn't corpsing, I have no idea. Steve's blank expression is less surprising. Kids' TV presenters tend to have a kid's sense of humour, so this stuff is probably straight over his head. Of course, little do they know, I have an ulterior motive. This isn't just some surreal outburst of physical comedy that bears comparison with the Best of the Goons show. I mean, it is that, but it's also something else. It's not often one gets a platform like this, and while Backshaw may be standing there like a pudding, I've seen the opportunity to tell people about my walk, and it's an opportunity I intend to seize with both feet. My calculations are simple. With my side-to-side jumping becoming increasingly frantic, people will be unable to take their eyes off me. In the 15 or so seconds before I become exhausted and have to stop for a nap, I'll outline the significance of my journey, list the towns I'll be passing through in the coming days, and recommend some spots to grab a bite to eat along the way. Just quote the word footsteps when making your booking for 10% off the bill. Offer does not include alcohol.
It promises to be a mesmerizing piece of infotainment, and I can't help but snigger at how I'm about to totally own Steve Backshall. So we've heard all about Steve's walk, I mime a large yawning gesture, and although Giles doesn't laugh, I can tell he wants to. Well, now let's hear about my... Ow! Glass! That was glass! I've trodden on glass. I'm surprised at how much blood a heel contains. Then again, if blood is going to gather anywhere, it stands to reason it should be in the feet. I take off, wheeling around the car park like a spooked horse on its period. What a horrible image. Unaware that it's only a small cut, my first thoughts turn to crisis management. I scream at the top of my voice, "Tell the BBC they're sending me private. There's no way I'm using the NHS." "It's okay," replies Brandreth, as I complete my third circuit of the car park. "I'm sure they'll foot the bill." What an absolute a-hole. I vow there and then never to watch another episode of Countdown. And Shagadog, it had to be my left, didn't it? Ignore the film of the same name, because my left foot is the real story here. Several years ago I pierced this foot on a spike whilst hurdling some railings to rescue a corporate function. After a series of operations and a dozen Paul McKenna hypnotherapy sessions, the foot finally stopped aching. Then, a few years ago, I was shot in the left ankle by a madman's shotgun, and now this gash. The gunshot wound, by the way, hurt like billio, and I've only just stopped telling people about it, although I shall now start telling people about it again, as this will allow me to complete the following chapter.